In the liturgical traditions of Judaism and Christianity, a feast day actually begins at sundown the night before. And in that way of keeping track of time, we're already into the beginning of the remembrance of this transition of G.I. Gurdjieff out of human bodily form into whatever of those being realms he pointed us to during his time on earth. We'll take it as a living wager that he's not God. So before we begin to open the field to conversations and discussions and observations, there's one piece that we do have to begin to drop in tonight so that it doesn't take you by surprise tomorrow, and so that we begin to set the emotional climate in which anything that might happen in the rest of the week can unfold with its due spaciousness. And this is to begin to understand how much this sacred phrase, "Lord, have mercy," impacted Gurdjieff's heart, his teaching, his basic understanding of everything. You simply can't extricate it from him or him from it. And until you can find a way into it in your own space, I think you'll never get to the heart of where he's teaching from. You hear the words, but it doesn't register. That in some sense, this most sacred of all religious liturgical phrases in the Orthodox tradition in which he was born and moved, has bearing, has very deep heart bearing on what he understood, on what he taught. And what we're going to see tomorrow is a softening of that pessimism that meets you on the surface. So, just a little bit of sketching the background. In the Orthodox tradition, he would have met this in two forms because they interact with each other. They are like two banks of the river in which Orthodox spirituality flows. One is in the form of the great Trisagion chant, which you've just heard, the threefold name of God. And some of you in the English tradition may remember it as, Holy God, Holy the Firm, we like to say, Holy Undying One, or Holy Immortal One, have mercy on us. Agios, Holy, O Theos. Oh, Holy God, that O in the middle is the explanation. Agios Ischiros, the strong one. I always think of Icarus, even though I'm not supposed to be flying to the sun, you know. Holy the sun. And you could say it, Ish. It's not Ischiros, that's too Western, but it's not Ischiros. It's somewhere in between. Holy the strong. Agios Apatatos, Holy the Undying One. And to say undying is really to say something that has a whole different punch than to say immortal, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, Holy Undying One, Eleison, have mercy, Imas, it's collective, it's plural. And it goes back and forth. So this is the beautiful Trisagion. And Gurdjieff maintained very strongly that this format actually contains a vestigial memory that showed up and was preserved in Orthodox spirituality of the Law of Three. That this talks about the threefold nature of the great, if God is essentially the principle of world creation. This alludes to the three lines. He lets you see this in Beelzebub's Tales, in his explanation of this in Holy Planet Purgatory, you'll actually find a place, and I didn't grab my book, where he's giving you, like, when he sometimes goes into these sort of pseudo-fake made-up languages, and he says, and this is remembered in the phrase, adios, o theos, adios, or slurp, o theos, slurp, iskeros, you have the page. And it butchers the thing on the surface. It's in the Holy Planet Purgatory chapter, but you can see so clearly that what he's actually giving you is the actual Greek. I mean, it's quite obvious that he would have sung it as a boy in the cathedral choir school, framed into his heart and soul. The music is, of course, lofty. You caught that just singing it this evening. So that's the one riverbank in which this Lord have mercy flows into his soul. The other is the tradition of the Jesus Prayer, the Prayer of the Heart from Mount Athos, in which they share the same line, have mercy. The Jesus Prayer is typically done privately and personally, and to Jesus Christ, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, in the simplest form. Lord Jesus Christ, only Son of the living God, have mercy on me. But of course, if you go to Greece, you're not going to find it said that way. You're either going to hear it in the Greek, agios or theos, or you're going to hear it in Kyrie Christe eleison, Kyrie Christe eleison, Kyrie Christe eleison, which is the format in which it's chanted at the monastery in Mount Athos, the great keeper of the esoteric traditions around the Jesus Prayer, from which many have suspected, and Joseph Aziz has suspected even more firmly, that Gurdjieff actually received many of his teachings about the breath, the invocation, the relationship between Lord have mercy and I am, from Athenite spirituality. The other place where it would have come to him very profoundly is that one of the most profound branches of this tradition is the tradition that flowed through the Russian Orthodox Church. And you would hear those same words, Lord have mercy, in Russian, or Old Slavonic, or New Slavonic, but you would hear them, in which they come across as, Deborah?
Gospodi pomiluj.
Gospodi pomiluj. Gospodi pomiluj.
The accent actually I discovered on P.
Pomiluj. So, so say it for us, my dear. Again, say it for us a few more times.
Gospodi pomiluj.
Yes, Gospodi pomiluj. And that too would have been heard. That is how it is in the wonderful prayer of the pilgrim that so many Westerners heard the tradition in. This is how it is. And of course, the language here is beautiful. That before you start paying attention to the context of the words, when you're dealing with a sacred and transmissional art like this, it's better to listen to where the syllables and the vowels vibrate in you. And this Gospodi, Gospodi, Gospodi has just got this open O. I worked with a fellow in Paris for a while whose specialty was really studying very minutely where the sounds, the vibrations of sounds, lived in the chest and what they opened in you simply by the sounds. And it doesn't take a genius to know that there's a totally different effect between saying, Lord have mercy, Kyrie Christe eleison, and Gospodi pomiluj. Hear how it resonates? It has to do with the O, which is the throat chakra, the place of deep surrender. place of resonance. We won't go too far down there. But if you notice the distance, there's something completely open and spacious there. So these great currents flowing into his soul, always around the same word, mercy. And as I say, now at the end of our postmodern West, we have a totally screwed up understanding of what mercy is. You know, we often hear it and react like it's a power word. Lord, have mercy, like, you know, juridically. And you miss this current of intense tenderness, of intense exchange that flows through the whole thing. And the tenderness that flows in both directions, not only from the creature to the creator, but from the creator to the creature. Again, because these things are not carried in the denotations. They're carried in the connotations. But Gurdjieff, everywhere he goes, you find it in the music, you find it in the prayers, you find it throughout the writings, this attraction to Lord, have mercy, as fundamentally connected to getting the scale right, to getting the relationality right, to understanding, in a deep way, the intimacy and the personal dimension, that who suffers is our common Father. And even when you translate this into French, Seigneur, ayez pitié pour nous, which Gurdjieff would have taught his French students, have pity. That pity doesn't mean pity like we hear it in English. It's the most tender, maternal. Hold us, enfold us. And in working with these beautiful mother chants that would have filled Gurdjieff's heart, you catch a current in his teaching that is invisible to the mind alone. And I hope I wouldn't be nasty to say that I think probably something like 85% of longtime students in the work have missed it, because they approach it too mentally. You get it in the movements, you get it in the music, you get it in the deeper thread where his soul directly feeds yours. But we're going to be working with this, this in various ways with the Lord have mercy, with his resonances both with the Trisagion formula and the Jesus prayer in the Russian version. And trying to steep our own souls in it for the next couple of days. Because I think it's certainly our gift to him to wake up this teaching and show you how the heart actually lives in it. But it's his gift to us to show us how to go forward into this broken planet and bring to it a different quality of presence that's not like anything I've seen out there in the whole cultural bank of helpful suggestions. So we'll start right off tomorrow working with this. Deborah's going to lead the sit for at least tomorrow and maybe for a couple of days as we begin to dig into the exercise, the Gospodi exercise. And will the Lord have mercy will be poking its head to the surface many times thereafter in various forms. Mm-hmm. So be prepared for it and open your heart to it and bring your questions, your resistances, your observations. Anything more to be said of that in the time? Yes, Deborah.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to say that for those of you that were here before, and those of you that are new, I substituted the Gospodi for Kyrie Eleison because I knew we only had 2 days, and when this exercise was introduced on the 9-month course, it was introduced after being on the course for at least 7 months, and so I only had 2 days, so I wanted there. I was hoping something would, that there might be more of an affinity to the Kyrie. But Cynthia convinced me that we should do the Gospody, and so I said yes to it. And then out of the blue, I got a messenger message from a friend of mine in Moscow. He had a word question to ask me. And so we talked for a long time. I said, now you can do me a favor. Can you please just send me a little recording saying the Gospody? And I realized I had been actually not saying it totally correctly. So it's only 23 seconds. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
All right. He added on me. He says just the Gospody from you, but then he adds on me. I didn't ask him to, he just did. So it's from Peter.
Suggest that you could transmit that to Bob, and Bob could send it out on a form to each of our phones or something, so that we
can
listen.
Are you on Facebook Messenger? Can I send it to you there?
That way we could have it as a sound file on each of our computers and webcams as we want it. Yeah, great. Okay, well, we'll see where that goes. We'll see what. On me.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just trying to think, is there anything else I need to say about it? If it's not, you covered it pretty well.
Okay. The two of you work it out. We'll get our way through it. Our Russian could be no worse than his English.
I just want to encourage you to be on time.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Words spoken. Okay, so comments, questions, observations emerging from the day. Bill.
Not so much from today as from yesterday, when you were going through the stages of consciousness. The mythic reminded me of a time too many years ago, a few decades ago, that there was someone who was doing a shamanic workshop in Washington, D.C., where people are quite removed from the shamanic world. And it, in essence, consisted of drumming for the weekend. Not much else. But the shocking thing to me, or the very memorable part of it for me, aside from my own experience, was that out of the, I think there were 32 people there. At least 30, and maybe 31 of the 32, traveled on that drum beat to another world, to the shamanic world. And what made me think about that in the context of what you're what we were looking at yesterday is the perspective yesterday of the different layers was essentially from the eye that's going through the layers, or from the cell that's going through them, or the worm or whatever. But it seemed to me like what that experience of the drumming taught me, and that, you know, at least led me into a metaphor, that now that's not quite how it is. It's all out there. And then we choose to participate in one part or another, either out of automaticity, out of the level of our physical being, or out of our willingness to do years of work. All of those things take you to a different place of a... this is a different, probably not quite the right word, but a pre-existing consciousness. And that what we're doing is aligning ourselves with some part of, the, of a consciousness that we can bring within us, but it's without us, it's beyond us, and it's permanent in there. Now, I don't know if that makes any sense in the context of what we're talking, but in a sense it's the exchange, the mercy too, that you're speaking of.
Yeah, they overlap. They do. I'm much more interested, in a way, in your not so much why the teaching yesterday should remind you of it in terms of just getting a logical explanation, but what's the heart connection there?
The heart connection was the remembrance of the experience.
Yeah.
And the word mythic triggered that.
Yeah.
There are a couple of other experiences that triggered too, but this was one that,
Interesting. Mythic is playing with us.
Yeah.
Yes, Matt.
So I was having a conversation a couple days ago with someone about atmospheres, mm-hmm. and they were sort of saying that they were viewing the atmosphere sort of like this force field or this bell jar that sort of mm-hmm. kept them from interacting with other people, and they could stay within their atmosphere protected. But it's not really like that. It's not this thing to keep us separate from each other, or, you know, not like we're in this force field isolated, right? It's more... Can you say something about it?
Yeah, it's
a hard time.
It's a very good. It's a very good nuance, which is lost on most modern Westerners. That of course atmospheres are blending all the time, but when they are out of control, unconscious, automatic, and dominated by passions, particularly unconscious and uncontrolled ones, and they simply fuse, you have a recipe for devolution, or for manipulation, for mass hysteria. That's the kind of an atmosphere that you can get generated at conventions, at Trump rallies, at born again revivals, you know, at the crazy edge, that we can, you know, that crazy out of control atmospheres can impact, affect, and radically escalate any kind of pathology that's already present. The whole idea of recollection has been in all spiritual traditions from the start. In the Christian tradition, it exists in the Eastern side under the term vigilance or nepsis, attention of the heart or guard of the heart. In the West, it exists under the name recollection. And what it really means is exactly the song that we began with in the morning. Keep within, and when we say, look here or look there is Christ, go not forth. In other words, the sense that when our attention gets drawn out of ourself by an object, that suddenly grabs our attention. Will, force, focus, recollection are lost. We get pulled out, we get pulled to the surface. And our culture is set up to jerk our strings in that way. And people that are always being dominated and dragged and manipulated and agitated by stuff outside themselves are puppets. You know, there's nobody home. You say, I'm going to do this, and all of a sudden, bang, there's a shotgun out in the field, and all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you say, oh my God, did they get the property posted? Oh, I hate guns. I'm in West Virginia. Are they going to kill me? Or, you know, off you go. Your mind is lost, and it's all because there wasn't this capacity to stay put. So the exercise is not in establishing a bubble that cordons you off from everybody else. It's giving you opportunity to create a space of recollection that you're not going to immediately squander on daydreams, external stimuli, business coming from everywhere. That you're going to stay right within that embodied place and learn to find repose in it. And as you learn to do that, you will go out to others in entirely different ways. And rather than it being fraught with these jumpy, turbulent outer agendas, still can meet still. We learn this on every deep silent retreat I've ever been on, but we learned it really, really intensely at Garrison Institute last week, that these people didn't know each other. They were strangers, and we observed a fairly strict silence with each other, a very deep guarding of atmospheres, although it wasn't put in those terms. But what broke through was such an incredible intimacy, as it always does. Because what gets in the way of intimacies is not silence, but our personalities. So these exercises in containment are really skills that are learned to allow us to interact with the world more openly and with a little bit more mastery and genuine receptivity. So it has nothing to do with protecting yourself inside a silo so others can't get with you. It's learning a responsible discipline of atmosphere management. And that's only the outer level. There's a lot more we could say about atmospheres, but that will do for this one. Yeah, Carla.
Just continuing on this mythic thing, as well as atmosphere. You walked up on the porch maybe yesterday and saw Amy and me and Anne sitting, and you had just walked by the practical work where the men were out working, and you joked about the mythic appearing in our kind of in this image of these men in the field, you know, on the porch. And so that actually was following on a couple of days' worth of us having some, at least some of the side conversations about how, I guess archetype and mythic are playing together. So, but one of the things I'm finding is getting underneath and you know, trying to figure out what is the actual feminine, the receptive force, and what is the cultural overlay on that, and what is my reaction to the cultural overlay.
Yeah.
And that actually does start to play with things like atmosphere when a receptive force that's been enculturated to be terribly attuned to people. So it's just been very interesting to watch that it actually does, essentially the mythic manifests.
Yeah, yeah.
In our very traditional, supposedly.
Yeah. You know, I think that's interesting, Carla. that's a really, really interesting line of watching. And rather than try and commandeer it with words, I would just say that what a blessing that a mansion can be opened up with enough rooms. That these very, very different takes, it can be seriously explored as structures of consciousness. And to continue the art mythology, you know, when you go into the Picasso room in a museum, you don't immediately say, oh, those Renaissance painters, that was junk. You know, that you understand intuitively that these are different modes of expressing something that is infinitely describable and yet captured in none of the descriptions. And my own sense is that these, if you want to take Gebser at word and consider these as structures of consciousness, they balance each other. And they're elements that we've gained in the mental rational consciousness that's dominated our era for 500 years, and really probably more intensely in the last 50 years than in the 450 before that. They're things that are definitely gained in a sense of the autonomy of the human person and the freedom within that autonomy. The freedom to be rid of a whole bunch of definers that come from just accidents, as we experience them in this consciousness, of our birth, gender, and etc. So we're out at the edge here of the maximum declaration of independence for the individual. But what you lose in the process of that is that intense sense of participative belonging in things that are more beautiful and ancient than you. And I remember what I always used to love about the Sufi things we went to, that the men and women participated, they participated equally but separately in the events, honoring the very, very different energies that they brought severally to the collective. And that the women were bearers of the feminine energy in both external and internal ways. And they understood that as a role, and the men bore the masculine and the sweat. And of course we all knew that the women could go out in the field and cut the trees down probably twice as fast as the men and carry them every bit as far. But the bearing witness to the archetype created a deep satisfaction in the soul, a deep sense of an ordered and coherent universe. So try that out on your 16-year-old granddaughter. But to get just a little bit of a taste that these different possibilities really shine different rays of possibility, and to learn to be, to manifest within the givens of your condition without feeling that that has anything in particular to do with your identity. It's merely the glass that the wine of you is poured into. But to have that kind of freedom is to also have a purposiveness. So I think you're perfectly positioned to confront the Shenandoah and the Potomac of our being today. The one thing I'm pretty convinced of is that as we emerge out the other end of COVID and the election, that the mythic will be returning in ways we don't understand yet, you know. And we're seeing the ugliest manifestations of it right now in the kind of bizarre and pathological adoration of this demonic being who's running our country. But there's mythical energy around that, and there's energy emerging that the people on the liberal left simply won't pay attention to because their minds are too busy talking about how stupid it is. There's some hunger. And I think that the Western soul at the end of the rational, the deficient rational structures, is dying of malnutrition and autoimmune. And some of the deeper food is to be found in some of these structures that we thought we'd outgrown. So keep it up. Keep looking. And keep looking from that place you're looking from. Yeah, first off.
This question has been with me for a long time, and I get a sense you may go there tomorrow, but it was very aware of the magnitude
of
human task in personal transformation.
Yeah.
And he wrote about that it can only be achieved through much inner struggle and inner turmoil. And he also wrote that the whole humanity is asleep and that man cannot understand anything unless he understands himself and can really reach into that vast reservoir of spiritual energy if he overcomes his egoism. So the question for me was, he wasn't, as we talked, he didn't, unlike Gurdjieff, really offer any practical tools, and it seems like he felt that it's going to happen automatically given all the forces of constriction and convergence.
Mm-hmm.
But given his awareness of man's position and the importance, it doesn't seem it's going to be automatic. It seems that it's bound to happen. And I'm feeling that we're missing something between those his awareness of the task and yet not really putting much emphasis into how that can really evolve. And it's kind of a question, is it, if we fail 1,000 times, it's still bound to happen, or what is there that's missing that cannot be so grasped?
You're fast forwarding to where I hope we'll be by the end of our inquiry, and it's a rare blessing to be able to voice that question, because it gets so voiced so rarely, you know, that and it's the very, very difficult question that I will talk about a little bit more, particularly tomorrow. Well, tomorrow morning, that's actually going to be the subject from two different views. We're going to look at it from the Teilhardian point of view and then from the Gurdjieffian. Because I think in both cases, their actions are a little bit at variance with their words. And if you read between the cracks, you can find the answer, or at least a ray of a direction to that question, which is an absolutely searing soul question. That it has a little bit to do with that age-old and never-resolvable dialectic between grace and works. There's a wonderful Sufi fable that says, You can't catch the wild horse by running, but nobody who's not running will catch the wild horse. It's that kind of an impossible thing that it's not going to happen automatically. You can't get conscious unconsciously. We'd love it if it were so. You don't wake from blissful sleep. I don't think you even, without careful preparation in some world, have a moment of permanent enlightenment from which you never turn back again. There's a long, tough slog of seeing and then not being destroyed by what you see. There's a long, tough slog of building the lower carriage, the nervous system, the three centers of dialogue, before you can stand the weight of what happens. All of these are true. And yet it's not before and after. That's where reducing the teaching to linearity loses the essence. The moment you allow yourself to see even a little, you are also, at that point, engaging the higher, the dimension of grace. Second conscious shock, if you want to put it that way, doesn't come at the end of a long, tough slog after you've mastered first conscious shock. They are bound up in one another, and there's some sense that second conscious shock actually initiates first. But I would say that in the work, if it has a place that it falls short, is because it despairs of grace. It's nothing, unless I'm pushing the boulder all the way up the hill, the boulder's going to fall back down on me. We don't truly understand yet, we don't trust the mercy that engages in our behalf as we start to work. We do receive assistance. Miraculous, joyful, out of left field assistance. But we don't receive assistance by sitting there on our plump little butts just reciting our theological formulas. You have to work and you have to know how to work. And it's getting the two sides of that together that is the beautiful work, particularly of this group right now. It's not that we haven't approached this threshold before. We approach it over and over and over again, but more forever. You know, the fourth way path makes it a little too hard. The Christian path makes it way too easy. And somewhere in the middle is something that is brilliantly right. Almost for me like those moments in movements when you couldn't do it and you couldn't do it and you couldn't do it and you know you gave up and you were going to walk off the floor but you were embarrassed to do that too, so you just stood there and, you know, collected yourself and picked your arms up again, and all of a sudden something was flowing through you and you knew not where it came from. But you were there. This happens again and again and again when we meet it with the slightest amount of sincerity and resilience. So we're going to try and unfold that a little bit, you know, with the looking tomorrow at the sources of TRC. You know, was he just thinking this all up? Or if so, what was he saying? What was the price he had to pay to see? Mm-hmm. The price in suffering. And we're going to play with that, and then we're going to ask the question with Gurdjieff, well, if he was that damn pessimistic, why didn't he leave? Everybody else left. Why didn't he? What's the quality? And it didn't seem like a dreary quality. It didn't seem like a gall. When am I going to get rid of you pests? It was something else that held him to the post. And I think that when we really, if we were subtle enough to sit through both of these characters, that it would wind up looking like very much the same substance. And it's that substance that God knows we want to taste together before we leave here. I think that's enough, actually. Let's put lights just a little bit darker. And if there's that fire engine bell out there, bing, something else to signal what passes for beginnings and ends. Thanks, everybody.